chapter 9, and what's unusual is that it's chapter 8, verse 23 in a Hebrew Bible of chapter 8. It's not the same. Now, obviously, these are the same in the sense of all the words are the same, but the pagination is different, that's all. Yeah, they thought that chapter 8, that it goes better with chapter 9. Sorry, the last verse of chapter 8, which we could call, that it fits better with 9 rather than the previous chapter. It really is a difference between gloom and hope, I suppose, and last week was gloomy. Chapter 9, verse 1, there will be no more gloom for her who was in anguish. In earlier times he treated the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali with contempt, but later on he shall make it glorious by the way of the sea on the other side of Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people who walk in darkness will see a great light. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. So this is very different than the tone of chapter 8. Chapter 8, which said, you're in trouble, you're going to have it worse, it's going to be really, really bad. I mean, that's how it ended. So chapter 9 says, you know, it was bad. It's going to be okay. And it's, again, a reflection of Yeshayahu. God will save. So here it is. I like the play on words, kilo mu'af la'sher mutzak. It's almost rhythmic. It's almost poetic. There'll be no more gloom for the lady in anguish. There's a real beauty to that. Only look where it's going to happen. He'll make it glorious by the way of the sea, which, by the way, is an Assyrian nickname for Megiddo. On the other side of the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. Wait a minute. This is Israel. Israel's supposed to be, where's the capital of Israel at this time?
Samaria.
That's right. And where's the capital of Judah?
Jerusalem.
Jerusalem. So it should be in one of those places. But here Isaiah is predicting, yeah, it's not going to come the normal way. It's going to be on the fringes, not the tzitzit, but it's going to be on the fringes. And it's going to be that God is going to come and make it glorious, not from center out, but from out in a way that is always the way God works. Prophetically, when you look at movements of revival, you look at movements of real stuff that happen, it happens not in the center of Judaism or the center of Christianity or the center of a religion, but always from the fringes. And then there's a new center that develops from there. When you think about groups like Jews for Jesus, and you look at the motley crew that we were in 1973 when it began, it's a bunch of ragtag old hippies, mostly from New York. I'm not, but mostly from New York, who say, yeah, I'm kind of done with the center of the religion. I'm going to be moving out. And it's the moving out when we're at the extreme or the edges of our religion, when God says, I think I can work with that guy. Mm. Not because we're rebels, but because we're open to consideration of things outside. So Galilee is nicknamed Galil HaGoyim, the Galilee, the nations. It's really not a very Jewish center. It's more so today, of course. Galil, which we're going to see in another word later on, means rolling. The hills are rolling. So look at the people who walked in darkness will see a great light. I mean, this is pretty exciting that this light, which we saw in chapter 8, is going to flash back again to us, and we're going to see it throughout the record of Isaiah. It's one of those themes like we see in the Gospel of John. Those who live in a dark land, the light will shine on them. That's hope. If you've ever woken up in a dark room, in an unfamiliar room, let's say I'm going to be in New York next month, and I'll be staying in a room that I don't live in. I'll wake up sometime in the night, I'm pretty sure of that. And I'll wake up, and what I will want, the first thing I'll want is light. Because if you see light, then you can see where to not step. And I remember a time when I was in a hotel and a drawer was left out. And I walked right into that and my shin really hurt. And I thought, why didn't I close that drawer? But the real question was, why didn't I leave a little light on so I could see where I was walking? Because light gives comfort. Light gives warmth, of course. And now in our days here, for those listening online, we are moving more and more into springtime. So we even spring forward with daylight savings on this weekend. You'll lose an hour. So light can bring comfort. It can bring knowledge, which brings comfort. It can bring heat, which when you're cold is really useful. Light is a great image throughout the record of this. Arise, shine, for your light has come. We'll see that in due course. Verse 3 moves it into a prophetic, not spoken to God, although some I've read consider that. You shall multiply the nation, you shall increase their gladness. They'll be glad in your presence as with the gladness of harvest, as men rejoice when they divide the spoil. For you shall break the yoke of their burden and the staff of their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor, as at the battle of Midian. There's a change of mood that dominated everything before. God's going to turn things around. With almost an eagerness, there seems to be a change here. Breaking the yoke of their burden. That's beautiful. It's a comfort. It's an assurance. And verse 5, every boot of the booted warrior, it's a repeat. Sa'on is repeated, and we'll see that a couple times through the record of the book, where he uses a noun at once and an adjective right after that, so that you really get it. And boots are on the ground, every boot of the booted warrior in the battle tumult, cloak rolled, there's the word galal again, in blood will be for burning. Fuel for the fire. There's a sense of historical trouble here in this moment. Cloaks rolled in blood, burning, fuel, fire. This is not good. This is the damage that Assyria will cause as they come through the way of the sea, as they come to conquer Samaria and what we thought was going to be a safe haven. Remember, Israel, Samaria, called Ephraim, earlier chapters, had made an alliance with Damascus, Syria, to take on Assyria, and they're going to lose. It's not going to be good. This is the political section of Isaiah. It sounds like it should be in Handel's Messiah, and it is, but it's really in the political section of Isaiah, which some want to walk away from. Verse 6, for a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us. That's a classic Hebrew poetic style. Child is born, ki yeled yulad lanu, a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us. But think of it this way, a child will be born, that's Yeshua, son of God, a son will be given, capital S, son of God. So we have God the Son. I love that we get that. Remember in chapter 6, we saw Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Lo kol haaretz kvodo. That's it. This idea of Father, Son, Holy Spirit, holy, holy, holy. It's kind of hinted in the book, but it's not as clear as it becomes revealed later. So, this was not a prophetic for someone born next week or next year. This is a full-on, actually double question. Something's going to be. Look at what it says. In context, this is not only about the first coming of Yeshua. Look what it says. A child is born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. When did that happen? It hasn't happened yet. His name will be called, this is so beautiful, Pele Yoetz, El Gibor, Aviad, Sar Shalom. Be beautiful. His name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. Really, Father of Eternity might be a better way to call it, Aviad. There'll be no end to the increase of his government or of peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. That hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. So this is a child will be born in 700 years. The government will be on his shoulders. In a way, we would say the government's all over his back. But that's not what it means. It means he's going to bear the brunt of government. He's going to be like Samson to the temple. He's going to be, put it on my back, I'll take care of it. Or like a basketball player or a football player says, I'm going to carry the team with me. He says, the team needs me, so get on my back. Not get off my back, but get on my back. In the sense of the government will be on his shoulder. He can handle it. That's why he's Sar Shalom, Prince of Peace. Or in the Russian language, Vladimir, that's it, Vladimir, Prince of Peace. So here's this child who's going to be a governmental authority. In context, probably Isaiah's people, mind you, he's prophesying to Judah, principally, the southern boys. They're probably thinking, good, we're going to get one of our boys back on the throne, and we're going to take him down. We're going to take down the Assyrians. little do they know, they're going to be taken out as well. But they're seeing it in the immediate context. Mm-hmm. And Isaiah is saying, yeah, this is down the road a fair track. This is not right away. And I like that it is a fulfillment in this word, in verse 7, to establish it. This is not just to give it a try like the four times. How many prime ministers have we had in
five
in the last 4 years? Yeah, no, this is going to be established. This is going to be fixed. This is not going to be messing around. We're not going to vote somebody out next week. When he takes it on board, when he's King of Kings and he puts his foot down on the Mount of Olives, it will be established under his authority. And to uphold it with justice and righteousness. So there's something that's going to maintain this thing. It's not just voted in, it's permanent.
Yes.
That hasn't happened yet. When's that going to happen?
Jesus comes.
When Yeshua returns. That's it. And no other time before then. So wait a minute. What if we vote on and have a good premier and have a great prime minister or president in the United States? Yeah. What if, can't we have righteous government? Aren't we supposed to do that? So we'll be human. Should we vote, therefore, for bad people so that the world gets worse? So you want to vote. You want to vote for good people. But you can't vote for the establishment of justice by people because people will always fail because we're fallen people, because we're human. So it's a real tough one because what we have today in modern-day world, in many of certainly Western countries and in Australia, which is an Eastern country, so the establishment of justice is a good thing, but it's not going to happen. And yet we have this demand within the human enterprise of democracy, which did not ever exist. It never existed in those days. That's a late medieval, it's after the medieval period when it was created in the world. From then on and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will accomplish it. I love that.
Yes.
It is the fire of God. That's what it's going to take. It's a word that means anger, envy, jealousy, passion, rivalry, and zeal. It's all those things. Pretty remarkable. So, verse 8, change of tone. The Lord sends a message against Jacob, and it falls on Israel. Now we get new names, Jacob and Israel. Should I go back? Let's not run away. Verse 6, which is the classic that's found in Handel's Messiah. Tell me what you think when you hear this phrase, his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince. What does it tell you? Some thoughts. Who needs counselors? Ooh, kings do. And you said everybody.
Everybody. We all said. Right.
When you hear the word counselor, what is that? What's the verb? Not, don't just say counsel, but what's he going to do?
Instruct, advise, teach us, advise, help us.
Oh, an advocate, yes, who's going to go before, kind of battle on your behalf, and yet instruct and inform and teach. Okay, what else is there? Wonderful. He's wonderful. But when you say wonderful, it's an adjective, but in Bible it was always a noun first. When you stand at the seashore and see a sunset or a sunrise, it's a wonder.
Yes.
A wonder means it's not pedestrian. A wonder means it's something that is awe-inspiring. We use the phrase in the verb form, I wonder what that's about. You see a bright light, you say, I wonder what that was. Meaning, I don't know, and I want to know, and I'm curious, and it's drawing me. That's the name of this child who's born. He is a wonder to behold. You remember in Fiddler on the Roof when the tailor Model Kenzoil starts singing Wonder of Wonder.
Miracle of Miracle.
Yeah, why? Because God made her for me. Wonder of Wonder. And, you know, when you looked at him, I'd join him in that. But this is the idea of the script of the biblical term pele, this idea of wonder. This battle, remember the first World Wrestling Federation between Jacob and the angel?
Yeah.
And he said, what's your name? And he said, my name is Wonder. It's Pele. That was the name of the angel that was battling with Jacob, our forefather? Was that Yeshua? No. What does it say to you that he is mighty God, El Gibor? Number one, what? He's numero uno. He's in control. Yeah. Mighty God, Gibor, strong power, strength. So when you think of a child being born and he'll be called El Gibor, you think, well, he's a kid, you know. Yeah. You don't put a kid up as a regent. This doesn't mean the son is the father. This is a problem for Trinitarians or non-Trinitarians, I guess. Obviously, it's not the same. But he's father of eternity. If he's mighty God and is in control and can dominate, then it's not just for a moment. He's the father of all time. So it's not a one-off moment when he's going to rule. He's going to rule forever, which means he did rule previously.
Yep.
So I look at my messed up life and I say, well, somebody better fix it. Hey, somebody's already been shepherding me. The Lord is my shepherd doesn't mean the day I got saved, he became my shepherd and I became his sheep.
Yeah.
It is the Lord has always been my shepherd.
Yes.
And therefore, the way I got to him, albeit weird, is his way of getting me.
Yeah.
And he's going to keep being my shepherd, aviad, until forever.
Mm-hmm.
There's no time. He doesn't take time off for good behavior. He doesn't go on holidays.
Yeah.
God is ever on duty. What do we know about Yeshua? He ever lives to make intercession for us. He is always on duty.
Yes.
He doesn't clock out. He's there and he's interceding.
He neither slumbers nor sleeps.
That's
So when you used the term advocate earlier, an advocate is like a lawyer, isn't it? A go-between, somebody who will fight your battles. So that's what Yeshua is doing. He's ever living to make intercession for us, to make us into the people of God the way he wants us to be. He's praying, which is kind of cool to ponder. And he's got authority to pray. I mean, you and I pray and we wonder, did that just bounce off the ceiling or did it dribble out of my mouth? Is God even in the same postcode as me? But Yeshua gets his prayers heard and will be answered. That is to be sure. And then finally, Prince of Peace.
Yes.
Who makes peace? Who can make peace? Okay, God of Peace makes peace. How does he make peace? Just think about troubles you had with your sister. And your mom and dad, one of them comes in, and you've got battle scars, or she does. Right? And he's going to make peace. How does he make peace? Forcing you together and establishing his rule.
Yeah.
So this is all, it's all the establishment of God's kingdom, which causes him to be declared Prince of Peace. Prince, not in the sense of junior. Like there's the King of Peace and he is the Prince.
Amen.
No, it means the Governor of Peace, the Ruler of Peace.
Okay.
So he's not like, well, he's like, give me the real King, the real boss. Somebody take me to the boss. No, he's the boss. And the way he establishes peace is by establishing his authority in every situation. Verse 8, the Lord sends a message against Jacob. This is not ever good news. When you get an email that says, you are in trouble, this is God's way of saying, don't be so smart, Alec. And it falls on Israel, and all the people know. And they, that is Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, asserting in pride and in arrogance of heart. This is a horrible thing. You know, right now, you're the one he's talking to. The bricks have fallen down, but we'll rebuild with smooth stones. Sycamores have been cut down, but we'll replace them with cedars. I think it's dangerous to look at a biblical nation 700 years before Yeshua and say, this is the United States of America today, 2,700 years later. I think it's dangerous theologically. I think it's wrong. I think you can make applications. That's okay. But to say this is that is worrisome to me. But yeah, that's what Jonathan Kahn uses as a sycamore. Yeah. The Lord raises against them adversaries from Rezin and spurs their enemies on. Now this sounds horrible. Why in the world would God stir the enemies of the Jewish people against Jewish people? He wants them something like that close. It's get a a good verb. He wants them to, he wants something from Israel, that's to be sure. What does he want? He wants them to know where they're at and where he's at and to see the disparities so that he can establish his authority. That's the point. So when the kids are fighting in the back seat of the car, oh Lord, do I remember. Anyway, the kids battling in the back seat, then he says, I'm stopping the car and we're going to get it right. And we're not going to get it right because Johnny and Susie are going to all agree now, but because I'm putting my foot down. When I put my foot down, that's the rule and that's the way it's going to be. So he's got to call us almost like a subpoena into a courtroom. And he's going to call these other guys as testimonies against us. The Arameans on the east and the Philistines on the west, and they devour Israel with gaping jaws. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away. Verse 12 is the first of three times he says this, and his hand is still outstretched. A whole pair with gaping jaws. It's really not jaws, is it? With all mouth. A whole pair with all mouth. Now, when does your mouth open like that? They devour Israel with gaping, with all mouth. So they are gobbling. So it's a real hunger, isn't it? There's a ferocious swallowing. I'm going to take you all in. There's something about it that is violent. Maybe why they use the word jaws, which sounds like not the shark of the movies, but something about nothing will escape this consumption of Israel by the enemies of Israel. You're not going to escape. So when you read verse 12, and his hand is still stretched out, you could read that as, that's okay, hang in there, his hand is reaching out for you. But that's not the way it's written. It's not the right hand of mercy. It's the left hand of justice. His hand is still stretched out. You think you're going to escape for one reason or another. You're not going to. His hand is still stretched out. Yet the people don't turn back to him who struck them, nor do they seek the Lord of hosts. So the Lord cuts off head and tail from Israel, both palm branch and bulrush, in a single day. The head's the elder and honorable man. Prophet who teaches falsehood is the tail. So both government and religion are messed up. There's no hope. We've lost it in economics, we've lost it in politics, we've lost it in religion. Everywhere where a person might turn for governmental assistance, if you will, for authority to establish, help us, the Assyrians, Trump, are coming into town, we're going to die. So we turn to our elder, or honorable man. That's the head, but I'm afraid the Lord cuts off the head. We turn to the prophet who teaches, but he's teaching falsehood. He's the tail, and that's going to be cut off. In other words, nowhere is secure. For those who guide these people are leading them leading them astray, and those who are guided by them are brought to confusion. I thought it was Babel, but it's not. It's Bulaim, to confusions, if you will. Therefore, the Lord doesn't take pleasure in their young men, nor does he have pity on their orphans or their widows. For every one of them is godless and an evildoer, and every mouth is speaking foolishness. In spite of all this, his anger doesn't turn away, and his hand, second time, is still stretched out. So the first time I read this, I thought, oh good, his hand of mercy is still stretched out, but it's not the way it is. So when God calls you to justice, to change, to repent, and you don't, his hand is still stretched out. Like in NCIS, when he hits the back of the head, Look at that. The young men should be the place where there's pleasure. The Lord should have pleasure in young men. These are the future. But he doesn't have any. Why? Because the elders have tainted the young men. The prophets have tainted the young men. So now there's not even hope there. And when you think about judgment in the Bible, whether it's on Sodom and Gomorrah or on Israel in this case, you think, now why would God judge people? God's a nice God. He likes people. He wants everybody to go to heaven. Yeah, and then to trust him in all circumstances and go the right way. So when he continues to be involved with us, whacking us upside the head, it is for our good. That's why it's still his hand that's reaching out to us. I just love that about God. He's not done with us, but he'll turn us over to troubles so that we learn, so that we come back. Look at this verse in Hebrews chapter 12. Since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let's lay aside all this stuff. Let's drop it off. Let's get rid of it and run with endurance. Asher just ran the city to surf. You didn't carry a backpack, did you? No. You didn't carry rocks in your shoes. You wanted to get rid of stuff. And the more the merrier, you know, the lighter. So he says, because we got all these Old Testament saints around kind of cheering us on in the stadium, let's lay aside all this stuff that hinders us and fix our eyes, verse 2, on Yeshua, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and he sat down at God's right hand. Now consider, verse 3, him who's endured this hostility by sinners against himself so that you don't grow weary and lose heart. So when you're in tough times, hang in there, but don't just, I'm going to do it because I'm tough. Consider him who went all the way. Yeah. All the way where? To the cross. Yeah. To deny himself. He said, verse 4, you haven't resisted to the point of shedding blood and you're striving against sin. So he said this, verse 5, and he's quoting the Proverbs, don't regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you're reproved by him. For those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines. Verse 7, it's for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. What son is there whom his father doesn't discipline? But if you're without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then you're bastards. You're illegitimate children and not sons. So if God, back to Isaiah, if God disciplines you, Israel, it's because he loves you.
Yes.
If that's his hand involved, he hasn't let go and said, you guys, yeah, I'm done with you.
Yeah.
Because just decades later, after Israel goes into captivity of Assyria, they're brought back to Samaria, mind you, in a questionable way of intermarriage with the others of the other races. And that's where the 10 lost tribes get their nickname. But if God's going to be involved in your life, you're going to have discipline. That's just the way it is. Otherwise, you're bastards. And that's not what we are. So back to Isaiah. Verse 17 ends with that second use of the phrase, his hand is still stretched out. 18, wickedness burns like a fire, it consumes briars and thorns, it even sets the thickets of the forest aflame, and they roll upward in a column of smoke. This is, obviously the word smoke comes from the word fire, esh, and ashan. They sound alike, that's what I mean. It's poetic, it's not the same root. We say the phrase, where there's smoke, there's fire.
Yeah.
It's got a certain rhythm to that. The poetry works here too. But it's a roll-up. I see it rolling just like Galil is rolling, just like the flames burning earlier. Let's just look at it in a poetry sense. Verse 18, wickedness burns like a fire, consuming briars and thorns, sets the thickets aflame, and they roll upward in a column of smoke. You just see the whole thing ascending in volume and in sound. Because I actually, when fire goes through a forest, it crackles and it makes... Have you ever been near a forest that's bushfire?
Yes.
They are loud.
Oh, yeah.
I drove not too far from one when I was going to the South Coast once. And I came back a couple days later. We were allowed to drive back through. It was... Smoke continued days after the fires had put out the fire. Black everywhere. Smoke still ascending. But on my way down, I was really, I guess, fortunate to get past all the trouble. But it was loud. You could hear it probably, I'm guessing, a half a kilometer away. And the volume of the sound was unmistakable. Properly called, verse 19, the fury of the Lord of hosts. By the fury of the Lord of hosts, the land is burned up, and the people are like fuel for the fire. No man spares his brother. What does that say? Yeah, it's more than indifference. It starts with indifference, and then it moves on to raging against your neighbor. Yeah, there's a lot of hostility, and even the rage that produces murder. Because you're trusting the guy next door. You're trusting the guy across the street. You're trusting, and now, if in a literal sense, all hell is breaking loose. We have nowhere to turn, and the people are coming against us from both the east, that's Assyria, and from Gaza, that's the west. So we're surrounded, and we're going down. That's where the flames are happening. People are like fuel for the fire. So all this rage that's happening in the community, all this rage, is actually people. It's not just the sound of injustice. It's people saying unjust things. They slice off what's on the right hand, but still are hungry. The proud are boasting about rebuilding. We saw that in verse 9. And then the fabric of society is going to chaos and violence. God says, no, I'm not going to abandon them, but there's no response by Israel except this combusting of hostility between neighbors. It sounds cannibalistic. I don't think we're turning to cannibalism. Dog-eat-dog world, where we say, I'm going to climb the corporate ladder, I'm going to get ahead of you by stepping on the guy below me, that kind of thing. There's this conquest mentality, self-reliance gone mad. It's a chaos, it's a violence that says, I don't need you, instead of v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Somehow it's a dismissal of neighbor. It even says it in verse 21, Menashe devours Ephraim, although the word devour isn't in there. It just says Menashe et Ephraim, Ephraim et Menashe. This one is against that, that one's against this. Menashe and Ephraim, who were they? Joseph's two sons. So what are they? Brothers. So this is the classic. Brothers are supposed to love one another. They're not supposed to devour or eat or be hostile to one another. And together they're all against Judah, who was their uncle, and the anointed one. In spite of all this, his anger does not turn away and his hand is still stretched out. Now that's not mercy, that's still justice. But it's God who's involved. With all that as the difficulty, don't miss the power, ki yeled yulad lanu, that a child will be born to us.
Yeah.
That somehow, even though today, or in the next 2 years, Israel's going to be grabbed and consumed by Assyria. That's when it happens. We're going to go down. We're going to be captured, taken into captivity. The world's going to be ever different for Israel, the 10 northern tribes. Even so, a child is going to be given, born to us, and his son will be given to us. And his name will be the one that will establish everything. We've had Sha'ar Yashuv, that a remnant will return. We've had Meher Shalal Hashbaz and Emmanuel, and God is with us. But don't miss it. This child born, who is not going to be born in the time of any of these guys, is the real hope of all Israel of all time. Now, would that comfort these fellows? If I say to you, in the year 2077, Israel is going to, Sydney is finally going to win the grand final in the AFL, and everyone will live peaceably with one another in a beachside villa. What does that do to you? So what does it say to you that in the year 2700, 700 years from now, that Australia will be the Mecca of the world, and everyone will come here to find water? We'll be the only place with fresh water on the planet. You can have some initial knockback. You can say, I know the reality today, and therefore it can't be. But most of us would say, who cares? That's hundreds of years after I'm gone. What does that have to do with me? Most of the time, prophets who predict things are talking about items that are hundreds of years or at least distant. And what they hint is important for us to grab.
Mm.
It's the hint that there is coming someone who will establish himself as the authority. And when that happens, no matter what else comes against us, she'll be right, mate. No matter what else, he will be the cause de endurance, by the which I'll be able to live a life my grand, 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 great, 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 great grandson will be able to endure life. If it's 700 years or 7 years or whenever, I've got a hope based not on what I see, not on what governments can give or what the Water Treatment Bureau can give me, but I've got a hope based on the sure word yes. of God that says, you're in trouble, you're in trouble, you're in trouble, whack, 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 but there's coming someone who will be Pele Yoetz, El Gibor, Aviad, Sar Shalom. And you take that on board, and your life is different. You take that on board, that there's coming someone in my lifetime, or five lifetimes, or 100 years, or whenever it is, then your life is changed. Your life is different. I believe that that's what Isaiah is talking about. Now, remember, in chapter 6, we saw that God told him, keep on preaching, and nobody's going to listen to you. That's not a sign-up I want to make. Yeah, I'd like to join. Now, where's that religion? Where can I join? Because as soon as you start preaching, they're going to hate you. Yeah, not exactly a lure. That's not a recruitment device, is it, to join Isaiah's Prophet Academy? Join me, and no one will listen to you. But he spoke the truth, and it was both foretelling, in the sense of the prophet to come, the one on whose shoulders the government would rest. It was foretelling in the sense of Mahershala al Hashbaz, and it's foretelling in the sense of Israel, you're going down. Assyria is going to wipe you out. It was foretelling and forthtelling, and when you get both of those, you got a prophet. But even then, the prophets in this chapter were the tail and cut off, because they were prophesying falsehood. And what was their prophecy? What would be false to tell Israel in those days? That we were doing great. That shall be right made. Yeah. Yeah. So if you want to be wrong, just line up with that school of the prophets. So there would have been some who would have been singing that song. No, there were not a lot of prophets in those days, in the biblical days. Not like we have Bible teachers today in abundance and on the internet. Well, that's Isaiah chapter 9. A hope that's not an immediate hope, but it's a real clear and ever sure hope. Messiah to come.